It's Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farad. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll learn why prescription drugs are so much more expensive in the United States than in many other developed countries like the UK.
But first, we're talking to a Capitol reporter about what's going on in Wisconsin state government.
Yesterday was the last scheduled day of the session for the state Senate for this year, and the state assembly will wrap up its fall 2013 session tomorrow. Here to fill us in on what was passed and what's still left on the table is Patrick Marley. He's a Capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, co-author of More Than They Bargained For with fellow Journal Sentinel reporter Jason Stein. Patrick, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Rob.
Well, let's start with this one. Yesterday, the Senate passed a proposed constitutional amendment that would allow members of the state Supreme Court to elect their own Chief Justice. What's next for this bill?
Well, this will now go to the Assembly on Thursday, and we'll have we're expected to have a very long debate on Thursday. A lot of controversial issues are up. If that passes as expected, it would then have to come back up in 2015 because it's a constitutional amendment. If the legislature passed it in both houses then, it would go to voters. They would decide whether to change the Constitution. Currently, the job of Chief Justice goes to the most senior member of the court. And for the last 17-some years, that's been Shirley Abrahamson. A lot of conflict on our court, a lot of disagreement. She is often in the minority on opinions, and I think there's a sense among conservatives that they would like the justices to be able to choose from their own ranks for who should be Chief Justice.
And critics have said this is just going to add more politics to the court, they make the case.
Right. The critics say that this is sour grapes, that we've had this in our Constitution for well over 100 years, and that it's a system that works. We shouldn't have this kind of a rancor to add to the discord we already have.
And before we break into more particular issues, you mentioned a lot on the plate tomorrow at the state assembly, including some controversial issues. Seems like the Senate decided to hold off on a lot of the most controversial stuff as the session came to the end. The assembly, not so much?
Yeah, that's right. Just prior to the last session day, it looked like the Senate could be taking on a lot of controversial issues, including some abortion measures, but they backed off on much of their agenda. The assembly is going to start at 1 o'clock on Thursday. Looks like they could go until 2 a.m. as they debate things like voter ID, limiting voting hours, the Chief Justice bill, restricting access to the mine site in northern Wisconsin.
And that voter ID bill, there's a current existing voter ID bill hung up in the courts. What's the difference on this new one?
Right. So we have there was a voter ID law that was put in place in 2011. There were four lawsuits filed. In two of those cases, judges blocked the law. One of those was overturned on appeal, but the initial judge's ruling blocking it remains in place. So the law really hasn't been used. There's a federal trial in Milwaukee on the law as well. And so this bill would soften the requirement somewhat so that people who had a religious objection to being photographed or who couldn't afford to get the documents to get an ID would be able to vote without an ID if they signed an affidavit. And the supporters of voter ID believe that if they can put that in place, it weakens the legal challenges to the law that have said that the voting ID requirement is so strict that it disenfranchises people.
But Senate Republican leaders at some points were kind of balking at this. I got the sense they're saying, hey, let's wait and see if the one we already passed gets through the courts before we start nerfing what we already have.
That's exactly right. We have Republicans control both houses, but there's a disagreement on this issue. The Assembly is moving full speed ahead to get this done because they say, Speaker Robin Voss in particular has said, he wants to do everything he can to make sure that a voter ID requirement is in place for the 2014 election for governor. His corollary in the Senate, the majority leader, Scott Fitzgerald, has said, no, this is in the middle of these legal challenges. Let's see what the courts actually say in all the cases, and then we can, you know, his belief and his hope is that it will be upheld by the courts. If it is not, then they'll have very specific guidelines as to what's constitutional and what's not, and they can craft a new version of the law to meet the court requirements.
So one thing that's been going on doesn't seem to have the partisan controversy around it. the assembly passed a bunch of mental health related bills. This has been a long time in the making, right?
Yeah, they've been working on this all year, and this has been sort of this bright point of bipartisanship. Every bill, they've passed 13 bills dealing with mental health. On Tuesday, all of them were either unanimous or on a voice vote where no dissent was registered. And so it's going to be quite a contrast between Tuesday when you have everybody working together on issues and tomorrow when they're going to be bitterly divided.
What kind of things are in those mental health bills? Briefly, I know you mentioned there's over 10.
There's a lot of them, but taken together, it's about $4 million more spent on mental health for things like mobile intervention crisis teams, peer respite centers. So these are respite centers that are run by people who have had mental health issues in the past, and people say that for like veterans in particular, it's very effective to be able to talk to people who have gone through the same sorts of things. And there's people in Medicaid programs that would be able to get services more quickly in their homes. Many issues like that.
And there was kind of a general recognition from both parties that some of Wisconsin's mental health system are out of date. We need to catch up here. Is that what brought that bipartisanship together?
Yeah, I mean, there's, I think that there have been a lot of problems in Milwaukee County, but really these are issues that face every county. A lot of county-run systems, and, these laws were put in place in the 1970s. A lot of people feel like the science has advanced a lot. Treatment philosophies have changed quite a bit since then, and they needed to get with the time, so to speak.
All right, ping-ponging back to something more controversial. You mentioned abortion legislation coming up in the Assembly tomorrow. This is stuff that didn't pass the Senate that they wouldn't, even if the Assembly passes it, they wouldn't hit till January, if at all, right?
Right. The one issue on abortion that the Assembly is to take up tomorrow would be to create a license plate that says Choose Life on it, and then it would funnel money to a group that would run what they call pregnancy crisis centers. So it's a place that a pregnant person could go and get information, but these are run by people who oppose abortion so that they would be counseling them not to seek abortions.
And objections from people worried about that very thing. That would be using state money, in effect, for a particular point of view on this? Is that the hurdle?
The opponents of it, they feel like it's a state sponsorship of a position opposite of theirs. But what they are more critical of is that they say these centers can pressure women, can give them false information, and that they don't trust that these things would be objective.
I say this so often on this show, it could be a catchphrase. This sounds like the sort of thing that could end up in court if it passes.
I haven't heard if that is something that could be litigated, but obviously the last abortion law that they passed, which actually restricted the practice of abortion or required admitting privileges for doctors who performed abortions, that went to court and was quickly blocked by a federal judge. The case is going to go on for some months or years, but it was immediately struck down.
So looking ahead to January, as a Capitol reporter, what stories are you thinking are going to be the big deal come January?
Well, I think a lot of what the Assembly does here, is they're going to move over to the Senate, and we're going to have to see, there are two other bills on abortion that have already passed the Assembly. A great question is, what is the Senate going to take those up? All of these election restrictions, is the Senate going to take those up? Another bill that the Assembly passed earlier this year would double the amount that donors can give to candidates for governor and other state offices, and also that would allow people to register to vote online. That was a bipartisan bill where Republicans were able to get a lot of Democratic votes by including the online voter registration. It's being met with pretty deep skepticism among the Senate Republicans. So the question is if that'll pass. Another bill, a lot of things have passed the Assembly and not been taken up by the Senate so far. One would raise the speed limit to 70 miles an hour from the current 65 on interstates.
All right, lot to look forward to in the next session. Patrick, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
That was Patrick Marley. He's a Capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, co-author of More Than They Bargained For with his fellow reporter Jason Stein.
Coming up next, we'll check the news headlines, and then we'll talk to a public health expert about why prescription medication is so expensive in the United States.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Asthma is the most common chronic disease in the United States, but it can be easily controlled with medications such as inhalers or daily pills.
But often these medications are expensive, even though they're much cheaper in other developed countries like the United Kingdom.
So why are these drugs, these devices, so expensive in the U.S.? Here to help us answer that question today is Gerard Anderson. He is a professor of health policy and management and of international health at the Johns Hopkins University Bloomberg School of Public Health. He's also a professor of medicine at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine and director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Hospital Finance and Management. Gerard Anderson, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
I want to start out with kind of a general question because, you know, these days so often we hear that we live in a global marketplace where, you know, the products that we buy here in America are influenced by where they're manufactured and what the price might be somewhere else and so forth. But with prescription medication, it seems like we've got these islands where it costs one price in the United States, something else in the UK, and something else somewhere else. Why is that?
Well, because basically other countries negotiate as a country for prices. And we're really talking primarily right now about brand name drugs, not the generic drugs, not the. So with those, we're paying about twice as much in the United States as compared to other countries because they buy them as one country, and we have Medicare doing it, and Medicaid doing it, and United Healthcare doing it, and everybody doing it, and having so many people buying drugs means that we just end up paying about twice as much as what everybody else is paying.
And so can you give me an example? And it, this carries over, too, as I understand it. You mentioned brand names a few seconds ago, but generics aren't always necessarily that much cheaper.
Well, they're not necessarily cheaper than the brands, but they are tend to be cheaper in the United States generally than they are in other countries. So we actually do pretty well in getting reasonably good generic drug prices. We just do terribly at getting brand name drug prices. There are obviously examples of drugs where we pay more for generics and examples where we pay less. But on average, we do pretty well with generics.
And in terms of a total cost to, say, American health consumers, what are we talking about here in terms of money? Are we talking millions? Are we talking billions of dollars?
Well, we're talking billions of dollars, but I think a better way of looking at it is how much does it cost each an individual person, and that's about $1,000 for drugs for an average person in America. And if we look in other industrialized countries, it's more like $500 a person.
So is this a trend that has been going on for 10 years, 20 years, or is this something that we've seen develop relatively recently?
We've seen this since we started collecting data in the 1960s. We just pay higher prices for pharmaceuticals. We always have, and unfortunately, we might always continue to do that until we really go like other countries do and either buy in bulk. Everybody buys it through the government or through some single source, or we find some other way to bring down health care prices and specifically drug prices.
Well, it is hard for you to say that without me saying something about the Affordable Care Act here right now. Is there anything in the Affordable Care Act, in Obamacare, that helps address this situation, or are we talking two different things?
Well, to some extent, we're talking two different things, but there is something in the Affordable Care Act that really does help the seniors, although it doesn't necessarily bring down the prices. So as part of the former bill that passed in 2003 that provided prescription drug coverage for the Medicare beneficiary, there was something called a donut hole, a gap in coverage. And the Affordable Care Act fills in that gap in coverage. So the Medicare beneficiary will not feel the price as much as they did before, but it won't necessarily bring down the prices in the United States for prescription drugs.
Now, and as soon as you mentioned the donut hole, I remember right after that donut hole was created back in 2003, 2004, you know, an endless series of stories on the donut hole and what it was and who was going to be affected and how you could avoid it and the insurance and all those sorts of things. But since then, it doesn't seem as though, even though we're talking about some pretty significant costs to consumers and some pretty significant amounts of money being made, this doesn't seem to be an issue that's always on the front burner. It seems like as though it comes and goes as donut holes appear and disappear.
Right, and it has. And the people that hit the donut hole just sort of accept that they're going to hit the donut hole and it was part of the system. But they heard enough about the donut hole to make it an important part of the Affordable Care Act. So that was the negotiation that the Obama administration and the Congress had with the prescription drug industry to fill in that donut hole. So the contribution that the prescription drug industry gave towards the Affordable Care Act was to fill in this donut hole.
So earlier in the interview, you said that the only way we're going to make significant progress in lowering prices is to bargain, to look for deals as a country. How does that process occur? Because it seems as though we're so sort of fragmented right now to bring all those pieces together into a single policy, particularly in the wake of the debate over Obamacare, seems like an awfully tall order.
It is. Well, one of the things that was the big debate as part of the Affordable Care Act and before was at least in the Medicare program, which represents 40% of all prescription drug spending in the United States, if they could negotiate as one entity as opposed to all the different health plans that are part of the Medicare program. If the Medicare program could negotiate as one entity, it would have much more bargaining power than all the individual entities have. So we might not be able to get everybody into it, but we could get the Medicare program. And then, since a public program, we could get the state Medicaid programs into the program. So now you've got over 50-60% of the expenditures in the United States for drugs in Medicare and Medicaid. And if they were a big bulk purchaser, that would be huge. And then it would be up to the private insurers to say, well, if Medicare is paying this, I should be able to pay this, and they might be able to tag along.
Now, as I understand it, though, Medicaid or Medicare is forbidden from negotiating drug prices.
It is.
So what's
that was part of the deal in 2003 for the prescription drug bill. But, you know, those laws get passed, and the laws can get amended. So one of the things that's possible that would actually probably bring down expenditures quite substantially in the United States, and the Congressional Budget Office has shown this, is to have strict negotiations by the Medicare program as a whole.
There was a story in Time magazine in the past year or so about how hospitals overcharge for medicine because it can be masked within a bill that insurance might wind up paying for. Is that a secondary concern in your mind, or is that a real issue?
Oh, it's a definite issue. I was actually part of that Stephen Brill article and had the last line, which said it's price is stupid in that article. Essentially, it's a huge problem. If you go to a hospital in the United States, you're not going to know how much you're going to have to pay. You're going to find out how much you have to pay 2, 3, 4 weeks later. There's no other industry that, at least that I know of, where you find out how much it's going to cost you 2, 3 weeks after you've paid the bill. And while you're getting the services, you don't know how much anything is going to cost. And what's even more strange is that typically you're not the person making the decision anyway. It's your doctor is deciding what drugs you get, how long you remain in the hospital. So you're pretty much powerless to make any informed decision as a consumer in the hospital.
And we've only got about 30 seconds or so, but given all of those ands that you just talked about, given Obamacare, given everything, is it likely that we're going to see any significant action on this anytime soon?
No, I don't think we're going to see any political action. I mean, the Congress is just tied up totally. So I hope we do in the longer run, but I wouldn't look for it in the next 2 or 3 years.
Well, thanks for the update. We appreciate your taking the time to be with us, Gerard.
Thank you. I'm glad to do it.
That was health policy expert Gerard Anderson joining us to talk about the price of prescription medications and what the future looks like in terms of doing something about those prices. He is a health policy expert with Johns Hopkins University.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, it's the birthday of a Wisconsin legend, Joe McCarthy. We'll talk about how Wisconsin influenced the senator's life, his political career, and beyond.
And we'll also take time out to get an exit interview tomorrow from departing UW System President Kevin Riley.
We'll talk about how surrogate births and the rise of surrogacy is starting to change the American family, both how it works and how people think about the concept of family as well.
Those stories and a whole lot more, it's all coming up tomorrow right here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Then we'll talk to radio host Tom Hartman about how to save the middle class. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett.
And I'm Gene Purcell. We generally think of skillets as being utilitarian objects, the workhorses of the kitchen, but they can also be works of art.
In today's Wisconsin Life segment, producer Aaron Klein brings us the story of a Madison artist making something beautiful out of the functional.
Iron is an ancient metal. Humans have used it for thousands of years to make everything from kitchen tools to old railroad bridges. Madison-based metal designer Alyssa Toninato uses iron to make functional art.
I guess like a lot of it is the utilitarian results of using iron. It definitely has a spirit or a soul of the Industrial Revolution, you know?
Toninato started doing the dirty, gritty work of iron casting when she went to school in Milwaukee and fell in love with the industrial heritage of the city.
I loved it. It was like that farm blue-collar thing kind of coming back. You know, there was definitely, there still is a raging underground there in the DIY culture, in the cross-pollination of art and music and film.
Toninato made her first skillet in the shape of Wisconsin in 2010. She made it as a kind of homage to the local DIY scene and Wisconsin's homegrown culture. In Madison, she named her iron art foundry Fee Lion Studios. Fee is the periodic symbol for iron, and the lion comes from her astrological sign, Leo.
I started everything in Milwaukee. It was all from this one print that I made of Wisconsin when I decided that I wanted to do a Wisconsin state shape pan. I basically printed the shape of the state as big as I could on an 11.5 by 8 sheet of paper, cut it out, traced it onto wood, made my like thicknesses, and then cut it out with that tool over there.
After doing the Wisco skillet, Toninato eventually cast a map of the entire continental United States. 48 individually cast skillets that together weigh several hundred pounds. Toninato makes the skillets by pouring molten iron into sand molds. After the metal hardens, the sand crust is removed, along with the rough edges. But after teaching herself to make the skillets, Toninato still had to figure out the best way to season them.
This is the raw material right here, what you're seeing. They come from the foundry just like this. We use flaxseed oil. It's I've tried so many different kinds of fats and oil, it's almost ridiculous. And flaxseed oil is the food-grade cousin of linseed oil, which is what painters used on canvases. It gives us that matte, black, very hard, impenetrable surface that we look for in the seasoning, and they come out very pretty.
She also appreciates that all of the materials are recycled.
We scrap it either through donations from people or we go to the scrapyard. So that was a tub. That was a really awesome avocado-colored tub.
Oh, I see the green on it. Yeah.
Yes.
Iron is a heavy metal. It's clunky. Toninato says that iron may not have the elite ornamental status of, say, bronze, but that's part of why she likes it.
I believe people do identify with certain materials, you know, and I think it's a subconscious kind of connection. I'm not so interested in trying to bring up iron as being like an equal player of some sort and to try to break that subconscious of people, but I do think that I enjoy celebrating it in a social context.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. This episode is produced in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. You can find more information at wisconsinlife.org. Coming up in the next hour, we'll take a look at new cholesterol guidelines from the American Heart Association, what they say about who should be taking statin medications.
Right now, we're being joined by internationally syndicated talk show host Tom Hartman. He's been called one of the most influential progressive voices in America, and he is sending out a warning that America is on the brink of a crash that could make the Great Depression look small by comparison.
His book out yesterday is called The Crash of 2016, The Plot to Destroy America and What We Can Do to Stop It. Tom, welcome to Central Time.
Rob and Gene, thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
So you say this crash is coming up, and we'll get into that more in a bit, but even in the subtitle you say it's a plot. Whose plot is it? Is this intentional?
Well, it's not that it's intentional like, hey, let's destroy America. It's more that it's intentional, like, hey, let's get everything we can as fast as we can by changing the rules of the game so that we can get it. And it's a game that we have seen before. In this generation, it's the Kochs and the Adelsons and the who are the visible ones, but and all the guys on Wall Street and the financiers and whatnot who are funding. People like Phil Graham, the senator who changed our banking legislation, Graham-Leach-Bilek, blew up Glass-Steagall, and the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, which took us from derivatives into an $800 trillion derivative market in 2008. Of course, Phil Graham did this in large part because his wife Wendy was on the board of Enron, and Ken Lay wanted this kind of stuff to happen. So it's the Ken Lays of the world who have brought it to this generation. 80 years ago, their names were different. It was the Rockefellers and the Carnegies and the DuPonts and the Morgans. And 80 years before that, their names were different in the 1850s, and it was Jay Gould and the railroad barons and those guys. And 80 years before that, it was the British East India Company and the barons of the industrial, England. At the time, but it seems like about every 80 years we have this, or about 20 years before every 80 years, as the people who remember the last time this happened start to die off, we get this bankster class, this very, very wealthy, powerful class of people who grab hold of our political process and change thus the economic rules in ways that make them vastly wealthier. And if that's all they did, fine on them, but in the process, they take an economy from being broad and diverse. It used to be you could walk in any shopping mall in America or any downtown in America, and before Reagan, and you would see virtually all small, locally owned businesses. Now, if you walk into a shopping mall, or you could drop out of an airplane at 100,000 feet and land anywhere in America and not have a clue where you are, because everywhere you look, it's the same Taco Bell chain or the Olive Garden chain or whatever. So it's that great homogenization. It's become top-heavy and therefore fragile and subject to crash.
And you say this is a cycle, you're arguing, that we've seen before, concentration of wealth, crash, reform, forget about the reform, and so on. You make the case that this time around it's going to be worse than some of the previous crashes. Why?
Well, just because it tends to get worse every time, because the economy gets larger, the stakes get higher, the people with enormous amounts of wealth and power have even more wealth and power than they did the last time. Their ability to manipulate things. I mean, right now, you've got six banks. Elizabeth Warren said this yesterday, amazingly enough. She wasn't endorsing my book or anything, but she said that the situation, I'm paraphrasing, but the situation with regard to the too big to fail banks, which brought about the 2008 crash, is worse now than it was in 2008. And in my book, the principal hypothesis of the book, in addition to these cycles, is that, and it's not a wave theory book, it has more to do with culture, but is that the crash of 2008 was the beginning of the process, just like it started in 2006 with the implosion of the housing. Housing starts dropped 34% in the third quarter of 2006. That was the beginning. Just like in 1927, you had a 35% drop in housing starts, and that was what set up the great crash of 29. But, you know, even a decade later, we were still in the Great Depression to a large extent. I submit that we are still in the crash of 2008, that with the economic stimulus that was passed in 2009, President Obama was successful in covering it up with baling wire and bubble gum. He would have liked to have actually fixed it using many of FDR's remedies, but was absolutely thwarted in doing that. And so here we are.
So in this coming crash, you say in 2016, what do you see triggering, I guess, the renewal of the existing crash, and what is it going to look like?
It's going to look very much like what we saw in 2008 and what we saw in 1929 and what we saw in 1856 and what we saw in 1769 and 1770. And that is bank panics, bank crashes, stock market devaluations, massive unemployment. I mean, this is basically how it always happens. We've seen minor versions of it, along the way as well. There have been a number of them. Typically, they're referred to as panics or as recessions. But the really big ones we call crashes or depressions. And it could happen literally tomorrow. I mean, it's just waiting. They've reinflated the bubble to an extent between Fed policy, and I don't mean this in the Ron Paul conspiracy theory kind of way, but the keeping interest rates so low and propping up the big banks has, the stock market is doing better than ever. You know, the very, very wealthy are doing better than ever right now. But wages have been flat basically since the Reagan Revolution, since we stopped the New Dealonomics and began Reaganomics. And now it's coming to a head. It's coming to a fruition.
It looks bad, but you have some signs of optimism. You say that this could lead to another era of reform in a direction that you're interested in seeing reform.
I absolutely believe it will. When President Obama was elected back in 2008, he was talking about, fundamentally restructuring things in the United States, bringing back Glass-Steagall, separating commercial banks from gambling banks, giving labor power with things like card check. The structural changing in some ways, although I have some disagreements with him on our trade policy, actually many, but Nancy Pelosi actually passed legislation out of the House of Representatives. It got filibustered by Republicans in the Senate during the first 2 years of the Obama administration that took away the tax credits, the tax breaks that companies like, Bain Capital got when they literally take apart a factory in the United States and ship it overseas. We've lost 50,000 factories in the United States since 2000. And this is not an accident. These are the result of specific laws that have been put into place at the encouragement of great wealth. In order to change those things, as many efforts as there have been made, and very noble ones, occasionally by Republicans, mostly by Democrats, but none of them have been successful because there hasn't been this real serious grassroots political will. I think that we're seeing the cracking leading edge of it in both the Occupy movement and the Tea Party movement. You're seeing the populist rage. You're seeing, people are getting at that, as Elizabeth Warren said when she was running for Senate, the system is rigged. But until it comes crashing around them, you don't have that overwhelming political will. I talk in the book about a New York Times front page story from the first weeks of the Roosevelt administration in 1933, where every member of Congress was overwhelmed with telegrams and letters that said, just do it. Just do what the president wants. Make it happen. We've got to go in a different direction. That kind of political will that empowers a legislature and a president to, and state governments as well, to make the structural changes necessary to put this country back together, is not yet there. Has not been there. We were almost there in the early days of the Obama administration, but we lost it.
We're talking to Tom Hartmann, internationally syndicated talk show host. His new book, just out yesterday, is The Crash of 2016.
And we'd like to hear your thoughts, too. Do you think that we're on the brink of an economic disaster? Do you agree or disagree with Tom Hartmann? that we need some major changes in our political and our economic system. And what about reform? Give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you can post a comment to our Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. We're back with Tom Hartman, internationally syndicated talk show host. His book out yesterday is called The Crash of 2016.
And we want to hear your thoughts. Do you think we're on the brink of an economic crash? What do you think should be done about it? 800-642-1234. Post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go straight to the phones. We've got Tim with us in Ladysmith. Tim, hi. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Interesting show. I fully agree with your guest that we are on the brink of a crash. I think all you have to do is look at the debt clock, and it's pretty obvious we cannot pay our bills. We're almost $200 trillion in deficit. If you add up Social Security, Medicare, and other entitlement programs we owe for the future. One of the things I disagree with your guest is progressives love to spin this as if it's a Republican-only problem. It's amazing that he completely absolves President Obama from any responsibility, and yet the problem seems to be, you know, we have this huge re-regulatory bill that was predominantly put out by Democrats, and it's not being enforced at all. The problem isn't reformation. The problem is lack of enforcement, these banks are not being held accountable for laundering money and other stuff like this, and this is outrageous. This has nothing to do with just Republicans. This is both sides of the aisle.
Tim, thanks for the call. Tom, what do you think?
Well, yes and no. The private debt problem in the United States, our federal debt is around $16 or $17 trillion right now. The private debt is over $54 trillion. That is a much bigger problem, A. And B, in fact, you could argue that public debt is actually private savings. You know, all that public debt is sold as T-bills, and not that much of it, maybe $3 trillion of it, is held foreign, so it's really domestic savings. The entitlement issue is one that we need to address. I don't think the solutions are particularly difficult. If Bill Gates paid the same amount of Social Security taxes as you and I do, then, you know, case closed. But if he's talking with regard to the regulatory bill, if he's talking about Dodd-Frank, only about a third of the provisions of Dodd-Frank, which does slightly re-regulate the banks, have been put into place in large part because, and I hate to be partisan about this because I agree, this is a bipartisan problem. And I think that is a reflection of the Supreme Court, you know, saying that money is not property, it's somehow free speech and corporations are people. And so you've got politicians of both parties that have had to pay the piper, you know, the banksters. But most of the provisions of Dodd-Frank that have not been put into place or not been enforced, that has not happened because either the funding or the authorization has been withheld in large part by Republicans in Congress. But again, I wouldn't blame the Republicans for this. And in fact, the reason why we picked the crash of 2016 instead of the crash of next week is because I believe that President Obama is doing, in fact, the evidence demonstrates that President Obama and his administration are doing roughly the same thing George Bush did. Bush knew in late 2006, that a crash was coming. In 2007, it was irrefutable. By 2008, they were doing everything they could to move it back to November post-election 2008 because they didn't want, and had they done so successfully, we may have had President McCain. They didn't want the outcome that they got.
What do you think of? I wanted to ask, actually, following up on Tim's call. How do you think President Obama has done anything at a fundamental structural level to prevent the crash that you're predicting, or ameliorate, I guess, the outcome of it?
I don't think he's been successful at doing anything. He has made several attempts. Particularly, there was a serious attempt to re-regulate the banks. There was a serious attempt to change our industrial structure. But, you know, your opening piece was brilliant about the Sea Lion Studios. We used to make things in America. When Reagan came into office, about a third of our economy was manufacturing. Less than 10% was banking. Now the fire industry, the banking industry basically, is 35% of our industry, and 11% of our industry is manufacturing. No economy has ever survived with that kind of a transition.
Let me come at you from a pessimistic angle. When you're talking about income inequality, the middle class, manufacturing, is there something fundamental that's gone on with technology? It takes fewer workers to produce something that's hurt the working class. Now, more and more middle class jobs have been automated one way or another. Maybe no matter what policies you have in place, those jobs aren't coming back.
They're not coming back if you're talking about working 40 hours a week. Time magazine did a marvelous piece on this back in the 60s about the coming leisure class, and they predicted that if productivity and wages continued to track each other as they had from the George Washington administration to the 60s, that by the year 2000, the average worker would be making about $80,000 a year. We'd be working about 22 hours a week. And if, in fact, wages and productivity had tracked each other, that would be the case right now. You would not have anywhere near as many billionaires in America, and you'd have a much larger and stronger middle class, and people would be working fewer hours. But instead, ever since 1980, basically, wages have been flat, whereas productivity has continued to skyrocket, and along with it, corporate profits and the profits of the people at the very top. And this isn't just rhetoric. I mean, you know, this is Department of Labor and, you know, statistics, pretty straightforward stuff.
In just our last couple minutes, can you give us your policy prescriptions? If an aspiring candidate came to you and said, Tom, what economic policies should I have to get us through 2016? What are your key items?
Well, we know how to do this because we've already done it in the United States. We need to start enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act and break up not only the big trusts in the banking industry, but in every major sector of our economy and relocalize our economy. Number one. Number two, we need to get our political system under control and get the money out of politics. And there's a variety of ways that that can be done. And number three, we need to change our trade and taxation policies in a way that encourages manufacturing inside the United States rather than discouraging in the United States and get back to a manufacturing-based economy. As a start, there's a few other things.
Sure.
I know that we're tight on time here.
Yeah, exactly. But do you think that, I mean, given what we see in Congress, in American politics as a whole, is any of that going to fly?
Well, what we see is if you look at Alexander Hamilton's 11-point plan that was presented to Congress in 1791 in the Washington administration, that's essentially exactly what it was. If you look at what happened during Reconstruction after the Civil War, after the Great Crash of 1857, that's essentially identical to what it was. And the things that I just outlined are all the things that Franklin Roosevelt did in the first 3 years as president, you know, among others. And I would add things like, you know, making the government the employer of last resort, which FDR added in. And building our infrastructure, which Abe Lincoln did massively, you know, subsidizing the railroads across the United States. These are, you know, like I said, we've done these things before. We can put this country back together after the crash. We can do it right now, you know, and prevent the crash. But like I said, there's not the political will yet.
All right, Tom, thanks for joining us today.
Rob, Gene, thanks so much for having me on Wisconsin Public Radio. It's an honor.
That's Tom Hartman, syndicated talk show host. His new book is The Crash of 2016.
We've been speaking with Tom Hartman. As Rob mentioned, coming up next, the news from NPR. And then we'll take a look at new cholesterol guidelines out from the American Heart Association and what those guidelines say about who should be taking medications. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.